When you think of the world's largest companies, Apple or Walmart or even Rockefeller's Standard Oil come to mind. But to encounter the largest company of all time, you would have to go back to the 1600s, to a time when the Dutch East India Company had monopolized the spice trade and functioned more like a country within a country than your standard corporation. With the power to claim land, make laws, and wage war, the Dutch East India Company retained an iron grip on the shipping of luxury goods over the high seas, and, adjusted for inflation, had a market share of around $8 trillion. It's here, at the height of this megacorporation's power, that our story begins. And I must warn you, this one gets gruesome. I'm Jake Barton, welcome to Historium. This is episode 47, Wreck of the Batavia. The Batavia was a sight to behold. The 175-foot-long vessel was the largest flagship in the entire Dutch East India Company's fleet, and one of the largest ships on the planet at that time, and the most expensive ever built. It was painstakingly constructed and immaculately painted, navy, maroon, and orange. In the dockyard amongst a forest of masts, on October 27, 1628, the Batavia was being loaded with her cargo, construction equipment, provisions, and chest after massive chest filled to the brim with gold bars, silver coins, and jewels, 12 in all. This was a significant portion of the East India Company's entire reserve, and it was to be traded with the locals in Java for valuable spices. This voyage's main objective was essentially a massive bank transfer. Along with the cargo, over 300 passengers shuffled across the gangplank and into their tightly packed quarters. Merchants, nobles, mercenaries, sailors, and their families. A medley of smells lingered in the passengers' noses, from gunpowder to tar to canvas to the spices being unloaded from other ships in the harbor. The journey from Holland to the Dutch trading capital in Indonesia would take roughly 8 months. It would be an arduous journey, but the crew of the Batavia were seasoned sailors, confident in their ability to guide the ship on its maiden voyage. The captain of the vessel was Arjen Jacobsen, a surly man with an enormous graying beard. He was as rough and tumble as they come, having worked his entire adult life as a sailor on the high seas. Though brash and a little too fond of fine liquor, he was good at what he did. And that's what mattered when hauling this kind of cargo. The Batavia's shipment was worth billions of dollars in today's money. Captain Jacobsen, despite his skill, was not actually in charge of the vessel. In the Dutch East India Company, the upper merchant was the most senior-ranking official on the ship. For the Batavia's journey, that man was Francisco Pelsart. Pelsart had already made several trips to the East Indies and was proud of it. He dressed and carried himself like nobility, and considered the crew and other passengers beneath a person of his status. He could not have been more different than Captain Jacobsen, and it showed, setting the stage for an internal power struggle. Another prominent passenger on the Batavia was Lucretia Jans. She was an exceptionally beautiful young woman who was traveling to the East Indies to meet her merchant husband, who had sailed there a year prior. She had found herself in the unenviable position of being an attractive upper-class woman trapped for several months on a ship filled with mostly younger working-class men. She would try to remain in her quarters as much as she could. Our final passenger of note was a man by the name of Geronimus Cornelius. He was a failed apothecary from a city in the Netherlands called Haarlem. He had lost his entire business to his debtors after his newborn baby died of syphilis. It turned out that people didn't want to buy drugs from a guy whose child had died of that infection. Geronimus joined the East India Trading Company as an under-merchant, which put him right below the upper merchant Pelsart and Captain Jacobsen. He had been raised amongst radical Anabaptists and was known to run with some religious and philosophical extremists. He viewed the upper merchant as snobbish and uptight and immediately aligned closer with the captain. As the Batavia embarked on its journey and sailed through the Strait of Dover towards the North Atlantic, the passengers enjoyed the cook's handiwork. Perishable food was naturally consumed first, so the meals started out all right, then became progressively worse over the course of the voyage. The crew had the luxury of being above deck most of the day, but any passengers, soldiers, and family members had to stay in the dark underbelly of the ship. Their quarters on the lowermost deck were small, just over 3 feet high, floor to ceiling. They smelled of vomit and body odor. The passengers were allowed above decks for fresh air and movement only twice a day for 30 minutes each, after which they returned to their squalid quarters. They did what they could to make the voyage less hellish by singing, playing cards, and performing plays. Of course, they could only distract themselves so much. As days turned into weeks and weeks turned into months, conditions below decks became nearly unbearable. To make matters worse, the nobles and merchants with quarters in the upper decks traveled in comparative luxury. Two soldiers guarded the chests full of company riches day and night, and each time they finished a shift, they'd return to the lower decks and tell the tales of the splendor that the nobles and merchants were living in. Jealousy grew amongst the passengers. Tensions were relieved, albeit temporarily, during a stopover at the port in Cape Town, South Africa. All of the sailors, mercenaries, and passengers finally got to stretch their legs for an extended shore leave. During the resupply, Captain Jakobsen enjoyed a little too much drink and ended up picking a fight with the crew of another vessel. Upon being dragged back to the Batavia, he was dressed down by the upper merchant Pelsart. When the ship left port the next morning, and the humiliated Captain Jakobsen had sobered up, he began to plan a mutiny with scheming under-merchant Geronimus Cornelius. Planning might imply too much foresight, but the pair at least began to sow discord amongst the sailors, mercenaries, laborers, and families. Nothing outright, of course, just hints and possibilities. They could sense the dissatisfaction emanating from the lower decks, and they knew they could use it in their favor. As strong winds pulled the Batavia east towards the heart of the Indian Ocean, the southern tip of Africa began to disappear behind the stern. The vessel seemed to be making good time, but navigation was shoddy at best. During this stretch, Pelsart fell ill, spending more and more time in his cabin. To the jealousy of many men on the ship, Lucretia Jans spent much of her time with Pelsart in his cabin. This allowed the mutineers to sow even more discord amongst the passengers. Soon, they hatched a plan. The mutineers knew they needed support, specifically from the mercenaries and the sailors. They needed the crew to see Pelsart in as bad of light as possible. One way to do that was to manipulate Pelsart into doling out harsh punishments to the crew. In order to get that, they would have to do something that would really aggravate Pelsart. One night, a sailor came across a woman sobbing on the main deck. She was covered in black pitch and looked like she'd been assaulted. The woman was Lucretia Jans. She was taken to the captain's quarters, and Pelsart was called in. The upper merchant was horrified at what he saw. Lucretia, the woman he spent so much time with, covered in tar and weeping. But he knew the tensions on the ship were running high. In a strange move that baffled both Lucretia and the mutineers, Pelsart did nothing. Figuring that they were almost to the trading settlement in Java, he decided to delay punishment and wait to handle the investigation there. That decision probably saved his life. One night, a few weeks after the assault of Lucretia, roughly 7 months into their journey, a sailor on watch spotted something strange on the horizon. It looked like whitewater breaking over something in the sea. When he reported what he saw, it was dismissed by his superiors as mere reflection of the moonlight. The Batavia sailed on. But that sailor was right. He did see something. Unbeknownst to the crew, the Batavia had overshot the point in their route where they would have turned north to Java, and the vessel was currently near a chain of minuscule islands just off the coast of Western Australia. These islands were surrounded by a massive coral reef that loomed just below the surface. With a sudden shuddering lurch, passengers and cargo were thrown forward as the Batavia slammed into the shallow reef. Cannons broke free of their holds and crashed through wooden beams. Men were crushed by shifting cargo, others stabbed by explosions of splinters. Water surged into the lower decks, drowning several passengers as the rest scrambled to get above the destruction. They emerged, battered, bruised, and panicked, onto the main deck. In the midst of this madness, Captain Jakobsen and upper merchant Pelsart deliberated. A few hundred yards away, they could just make out a small landmass. Pelsart ordered Jakobsen to begin arranging boats to ferry passengers to the island, along with the precious chests of silver. As the dawn illuminated the scene, he looked out over the swells, hoping to see the tide rising. If it were, it could lift the Batavia and release it from the reef. Instead, he saw the opposite. The tide was lowering, ramming the reef further into the Batavia's underbelly. As the lower decks flooded, passengers who could swim dove into the shallow water and swam to the main island. They were followed, eventually, by the lifeboats, which ferried everyone they could and most of the company's valuables ashore. As the distraught survivors dragged themselves up onto dry land, the Batavia slowly broke apart on the reef behind them. It quickly became apparent that the crew and passengers were stranded on a literal desert island. No coconut trees, no grass, no wildlife, just sand. It was little more than a few football fields in length and completely barren. One by one, the survivors realized the gravity of their situation. Hours before, they had been traveling on the most prominent vessel in maritime history. Now, they were collecting pieces of that vessel from the shallows. The rising sun bore down on the survivors in earnest. Their nightmare had only just begun. Pelsar did what he could to enact company protocol. He ordered some of the crew to collect broken pieces of the vessel from the shallows, while hunting parties were to search for food and fresh water. Of course, they returned quickly, as the island was comically small. They only managed to retrieve a few seagulls, and there was nothing to drink. Knowing he had to act quickly, Pelsart gathered the East India Company merchants in his makeshift tent and started to formulate a plan. Drinking water was top priority, as most of their fresh water had gone down with the Batavia. The hunting parties were ordered to expand their search to nearby islands as the remaining survivors began setting up shelter using wood and canvas from the shipwreck. All of the valuables were now stored in the captain's tent. The dozens of bodies now washing ashore were buried in shallow graves in the sand. As the sun set on the ramshackle shelters, the search parties returned from nearby islands, again empty-handed. Pelsart decided he would lead a voyage to get help. Captain Jakobsen agreed. They gathered meager supplies and piled 48 survivors, mostly merchants and other officials and their families, into the lone longboat and set sail for Jakarta. Pelsart promised the others he would return to save them. In the meantime, the undermerchant Geronimus Cornelius was now in charge. As he moved into the commander's tent, Geronimus must have held back a bitter smile. He was now in command, and it didn't even require a mutiny. The only downside? He was trapped on a desert island. But he would have to make it work. To you and me, the small island chain where the Batavia was wrecked looks like a tropical paradise. There are snaking white sand beaches, the water is a beautiful shade of aquamarine, and colorful tropical fish swim amongst the vibrant reefs. But to the survivors, the vast majority of whom could not swim, their situation looked bleak. They began referring to the island as Batavia's graveyard. With Pelsart and Jakobsen gone, Geronimus Cornelius took charge with an eerie confidence. He organized a small council to assist him in making decisions, including reducing rations by half and setting up a separate tent to house the sick and wounded. A few scorching days passed. The northern Europeans fared poorly, and most of the sunburnt survivors sought refuge in the shade of their ramshackle tents. Even at half rations, the food and water supply was depleting at an alarming rate. Geronimus began pitching some radical plans to the council. He tossed around the idea of starving the sick to save resources. Many members of the council thought this was a step too far, and some of them began to quietly question Geronimus' authority amongst themselves. But word gets around on a small island, and no one can sniff out a possible mutiny like a mutineer himself. Soon, Geronimus decreed that all weapons were to be stored in a tent guarded by his men. He then formed a new ruling council of men who were loyal not to the Dutch East India Company, but to him. When the old council found out, they were infuriated, but there was little they could do with the weapons under lock and key. Having solidified his complete control over all the survivors, Geronimus began to talk of his true plan. Hoarded in Geronimus's tent were 10 chests full of gold, silver, and jewels. With all this wealth, Geronimus told his followers that he would kickstart his own nation-state. Anyone who remained loyal to him and him alone would be provided a position of power, and many did rally behind him. He made clear that the establishment of his new kingdom would involve bribery and piracy, and likely the theft of the rescue vessel that Pelsart would return in, but the details of his plan remained vague. By this point, the water had been depleted, and a dozen people had already died. Though they were able to eat tropical fish and any seagulls they managed to kill, people were so thirsty they waited in line just to get a drink of seagull blood. Some caved and drank seawater, and then proceeded to go mad, rambling absurdities that echoed across the island. Others sucked on small pebbles in a fraught effort to generate saliva, so thirsty that their tongues felt like bloated sandpaper. One man, desperate for anything to drink, tapped Geronimus's keg of wine. When he was found, passed out drunk, Geronimus had him dragged to the center of the island and had him publicly executed. All this time, one young Dutch soldier, a man by the name of Viba Hayes, had been building a reservoir from the wreckage. Meticulously, he constructed a series of upside-down canvas cones that, if designed correctly, would collect gallons upon gallons of rainwater. When an old sailor looked up from burying the dead one day and began to shout that there were clouds on the horizon, Hayes must have felt a surge of exultation. A rainstorm soon enveloped the survivors, who danced and cheered, opening their mouths to the sky. For the first time in over a week, their parched tongues felt drops of moisture. Private Hayes watched carefully as his contraption worked. He was immediately heralded as a hero, which, as Geronimus saw it, made him a threat. A threat that would have to be eliminated. Geronimus arranged for his men to transport Viba Hayes and a group of other competent soldiers to an island to the northwest. He framed it as a reconnaissance mission and instructed Hayes to light signal fires if he found fresh water. Once they reached the island, Hayes and the soldiers stepped ashore, while the men aligned with Geronimus pushed off the sand and returned to the island where the rest of the survivors waited. When a plume of smoke did appear over Hayes' island, Geronimus ignored it. In time, it simply dissipated in the wind. With Hayes out of the way, Geronimus now had to ensure the survival of those loyal to him, while making those who questioned his authority disappear. He went about this in two ways. One was simply murder. He used his dark charisma to convince his followers to enact heinous acts of violence, periodically sending men out into the night to kill someone that he viewed as a threat. In the morning, the news would make its way around that someone had been killed in their sleep. No one would know who was responsible, and the sense of paranoia would lead to further acceptance of Geronimus's totalitarianism. One man who had yet to pledge loyalty to Geronimus was told that he would have to obey an order or he was to be killed. The man agreed to these terms. His orders? Go into the tent that housed all the sick and injured and kill each of them. That night, the man did what he was told, slitting the throats of the men, women, and children in the tent, one by one. Anyone who was awake could hear the sickening sounds, but could do nothing. From there on out, becoming sick or injured was a death sentence on Batavia's graveyard. The second way Geronimus eliminated competition was through fool's errands, keeping the survivors busy. He sent out search parties to nearby islands that had already been checked and double-checked. On some of these voyages, he ordered that men, women, and children be thrown overboard into the serene shallow water and drowned. All of this, of course, was part of Geronimus's horrific mathematics. By this point, only 130 survivors were still alive on the island. He knew they didn't have enough food, water, and supplies for all of them to survive until a ship would arrive, so he continued to thin the herd. Killings took place almost daily. The survivors lived in constant fear and saw, heard, and smelled nearly every act of depravity on the tiny barren island. Each of them was required to swear an oath of allegiance to Geronimus. Refusal meant instant execution. Clad in gold jewelry and fine clothes, Geronimus watched with pleasure as each and every survivor pledged their total and complete loyalty to him. Soon thereafter, Geronimus began making horrifying decrees. One of them was declaring certain goods to be common property amongst everyone. Property, as he saw it, included the wives and daughters of the survivors. Against their will, women and teenagers were placed in a single tent where they were held as sexual slaves for Geronimus's men. And Lucretia Jans would serve Geronimus personally. Any men with surviving wives and daughters who fought against the decree were immediately slaughtered. One night, Geronimus had a baby killed for simply crying too loud. Meanwhile, on the island to the northwest of Batavia's graveyard, Viba Hayes and the other soldiers were very much alive. They had managed to find water in a natural stone basin. They had managed to survive, and they were now preparing for war. The soldiers knew that Geronimus would come for them eventually. Under the leadership of Viba Hayes, the 20-odd men constructed makeshift weapons made of driftwood and nails from the shipwreck. They practiced throwing sharp bits of coral and rock. Using stones, they constructed fortifications and a sizable shelter. The men also found good fortune in regards to food. An abundance of small marsupials lived on the island and provided excellent nutrition. As the men sat around the fire, telling stories and eating their catch, they would occasionally fall silent upon hearing screams of agony echoing over the shallows from Batavia's graveyard. As the weeks passed, the depths of depravity back in Geronimus's camp became too much for some. Several groups made plans to grab whatever wood they could use to float and simply swim to Viba Hayes' island. Many made their break. Most were caught and killed, but a few managed to make it, and they told Hayes of the atrocities Geronimus was committing. However, with no rafts and no real weapons, all they could do was wait. Thousands of miles away, in the Dutch trading capital in Indonesia, soldiers watched in bewilderment as a longboat packed with starving, sunburnt men and women arrived in the port. Pelsaert and the others had finally arrived in Java after weeks and weeks of travel. They had gone up the western Australian coastline, then due north to the Dutch East Indies, in what is still considered the longest small craft voyage ever recorded. While the survivors of the wreck of the Batavia were treated to a hot meal, Upper Merchant Pelsaert and Captain Jacobsen were taken to meet the highest-ranking official the East India Company had in the Indies, the governor of the entire trading city. The governor, a man named Jan Cohen, was notoriously strict. When asked, Pelsaert and Jacobsen were not excited to respond to the question, "Where is the enormous flagship of the entire company?" The meeting went about as well as they could have hoped. Jacobsen was thrown in prison, and Pelsaert was given command of a smaller ship, the Sardum, and was told to retrieve the chests of gold, silver, and jewels, and return them to the company. If he succeeded, his punishment would be less severe. So, Pelsaert and a new crew headed back out to sea. Three weeks had passed since Viba Hayes and his soldiers had been dispatched to their island and left to die. Refugees from Batavia's graveyard, many starving or injured, continued to trickle in. Under the leadership of Hayes, the soldiers trained for the inevitable attack. They didn't have to wait long. At dawn one day, a lookout spotted rafts and rowboats approaching across the shallows, each filled with Geronimus's men. Hayes called his soldiers to arms as the rowboats approached the island. Geronimus's troops were hungry, thirsty, and heavily armed. Hayes's men were the opposite, well-fed and alert, yet wielding only makeshift weapons. They stood behind limestone barricades, wooden spears at hand, piles of sharp rocks and spiky coral at the ready. Once the boats were within range, they rained down a bombardment. Many of Geronimus's men were badly slashed by the projectiles by the time they even made it to the beach. Hayes then ordered his soldiers to charge the attackers, driving them back to their boats. They retreated to Batavia's graveyard to report to their leader that this would be harder than they thought. Geronimus was furious. Despite murdering nearly 100 people since the shipwreck, his people had nearly finished off their drinking water. It hadn't rained for the last few weeks, and the man who had captured it for them was now leading a rebellion against him. Even those most loyal to Geronimus began to doubt. They knew that Hayes had fresh water, and they would do just about anything to quench their thirst. Geronimus ordered another raid. Hayes and his men were again on the lookout. They saw the second raiding party approaching and yelled for everyone to defend their shores. Driven by thirst, the mutineers rushed the beaches. They too were beaten back, losing several men in the melee before making their retreat. Out of options, Geronimus himself led a third wave of rowboats and rafts to Hayes Island. As Hayes's soldiers prepared for another defense, Geronimus yelled out that he was coming only to negotiate. Hayes ordered his men to stand down, but to be ready to attack at a moment's notice. He walked down the sand bank towards the water with a few of his men. Geronimus, still clad in his robes and gold jewelry, stepped out of the rowboat and onto the island. Following him were several gaunt soldiers armed with swords and pikes. These soldiers removed supplies, clothes, and a chest from the boats and laid them on the beach before Hayes. Geronimus opened the chest, revealing a pile of silver coins that glinted in the overbearing sun. It was more wealth than Viba Hayes had ever seen, enough to ensure a wealthy bloodline under normal circumstances. But these were no normal circumstances. He knew the freshwater reservoir he controlled was worth more than everything Geronimus had brought to barter with. And if what the survivors of Batavia's graveyard said were true, if the stories of Geronimus' barbarism and treachery were accurate, then there was only one course of action. Hayes gave the order. A barrage of coral and stones rained down on the mutineers. Soldiers from both sides swung their weapons and wrestled each other to the ground. Blood splattered across the sand. Geronimus panicked as he was tackled to the earth by a large mercenary who pinned him to the ground. The skirmish lasted less than a minute. There were casualties on both sides. But Hayes and his men had won. Geronimus watched in horror as his few surviving men took off in the rowboats, leaving him behind, where Hayes' men dragged him to a pit and put him under constant guard. Night fell on the island. But before long, another raiding party approached the shores of Hayes' island. They desperately hoped to save their leader they had sacrificed so much for, and this time, they were bringing every able-bodied man and every weapon they had available. Leaving Geronimus under the guard of women and children, Hayes' men returned to the barricades, only to be met with a musket barrage. A man fell to the ground, sand turning red around him. Hayes' men did what they could with their coral barrage, but the mutineers made landfall and began advancing. Soon the two sides met, pikes slamming against driftwood maces. Hayes barked out orders and encouraged his men to fight valiantly in the churning surf. The tide of the battle had begun to shift in Hayes' favor when a man yelled, pointing at the horizon. A ship was bearing down on them from the north. It was flying Dutch East India Company colors. Pelsart had returned. Viba Hayes and several men piled into a rowboat and began rowing for their lives. The mutineers did the same. They knew that whoever reached the ship first would control the narrative, and for the mutineers, maybe even a chance to get the jump on their would-be saviors. Both parties rowed furiously as they approached from opposite sides of the ship, but Hayes' men were better fed and hydrated and pulled ahead of the mutineers. Pelsart watched in confusion from the main deck as the two rowboats approached with incredible speed. With moments to spare, Hayes' rowboat arrived first. As he and his men boarded, Hayes gave the most clear and concise warning he could. Pelsart listened with bewilderment, but he believed the young man. He ordered the smaller cannons pointed at the rowboat approaching from the other side. The mutineers surrendered, some throwing their weapons into the sea, and were quickly taken prisoner. Many confessed on the spot, confirming that everything Hayes said was true. Mindful of the reefs, Pelsart anchored the Sardim near Batavia's graveyard and headed ashore with an armed escort. There was little resistance. Bodies lay strewn across the small island. Panicked women and children emerged from their makeshift shelters and ran into the arms of their rescuers. Lucretia Jans and the other sex slaves were finally freed from the hell they had to endure, and they eagerly devoured food and fresh water for the first time in days. Search parties were sent out to the nearby islands to retrieve anyone else who had fled or been marooned by the mutineers. Geronimus was taken from the limestone reservoir where he had been held. He showed no signs of remorse. Pelsart realized the ship back to Java would be crowded, and he did not want to risk another mutiny, so he decided to carry out the trials here on the island. After talking to nearly all of the survivors, it was clear that there was little moral ambiguity present in what had transpired on Batavia's graveyard. Dutch East India Company law required a confession before any punishment could be carried out. Knowing this, some of the mutineers, despite the accounts of dozens of eyewitnesses to their violence, refused to confess in hopes of being spared and taken to Java. This, however, was unacceptable to Pelsart. Pelsart and his men began to torture any of Geronimus's men who did not confess. They tied canvas around the head of each mutineer and filled it with enough water to drown him, unless he drank enough to get the water level below his nose to breathe. The men who only days ago were close to dying of thirst were now forced to drink gallons of water or die. Their bodies bloated, and water leaked out of their eyes and noses. Many confessed, and many died of drowning or water poisoning. A wooden gallows was erected. Everyone who had confessed was hanged, one by one. Some of the worst offenders who had committed unspeakable crimes had their hands cut off before being hanged. Geronimus was among them. His wrists were hacked away with a chisel, and he cried out in agony with each fall of the hammer. But never once did he ask forgiveness or express any sorrow for what he had done. He was led to the gallows, blood dripping from where hands once were. As the noose was draped around his neck, he cursed everyone in attendance, screaming a hateful monologue. He was finally silenced when the panel dropped out from beneath him. The mutineers who were not executed were loaded aboard the Tsardom, along with 10 chests of gold, silver, and jewels. The survivors left Batavia's graveyard for the last time. Back in Indonesia, lengthy trials were held for the remaining mutineers. Many were executed, while others were keel-hauled, flogged, or imprisoned in terrible conditions. Geronimus's second-in-command was broken on the wheel. Captain Jakobsen was tortured for a confession, but never admitted to having any part in the mutiny. His life was spared, but he was imprisoned for his incompetence. What became of him is unknown. Upper Merchant Pelsart was tried as well. A board of inquiry decided that he had exercised a lack of authority and was therefore partly responsible for what had happened. All of his financial assets were seized by the East India Company, and he died in poverty within the year. Lucretia Jans was reunited with her husband, but had to defend herself against accusations of assisting Geronimus in his reign of terror. She was eventually acquitted and returned to the Netherlands in 1635. A few years later, a new Dutch East India Company policy limited the number of women on merchant ships, citing Lucretia, and claimed that their presence led to certain, quote, disturbances, unquote. Viba Hayes was hailed as a hero. He and the other loyalists were promoted and granted substantial raises for their valiant efforts against the mutineers. For a time, Viba Hayes was treated as a hero by the Dutch media back in Holland, but nothing is known of what became of Hayes after his return. He simply vanishes from the pages of history. To this day, the aftermath of the Batavia shipwreck remains the largest recorded mass killing in Australian history. And as is so often the case in history, we are left with more questions than answers. Why did Geronimus take the approach he did? Was it a gradual slide into evil based on the lack of resources? Was his behavior somehow informed by his radical religious upbringing? Or was he merely a sadistic psychopath who simply found pleasure in the suffering of others? Oftentimes we wish that Geronimus was simply a psychopath. It's an easy answer to a complex event. But the real question doesn't involve Geronimus at all. The real question is, why did seemingly normal people follow his lead so quickly? Why do people devolve into bloodthirsty totalitarianism when resources become scarce? The potential answers both terrify and fascinate us. In the end, of the original 332 people on board the Batavia, only 68 finally made it to Java, all of them bearing the trauma of the horrors that took place on Batavia's graveyard. Thank you. Historium is written and produced by me, Jake Barton, with writing assistance by Thomas Harlander. This episode was absolutely insane to tackle in just about every way. The details of the horrific violence committed is just numbing at some points. If you search for this story online, you can find some cool research being done by archaeologists in Western Australia. They're still finding skeletons in the sand on those islands to this day. If you're a fan of Historium, you can find the show on pretty much any social media platform. I run this whole operation on your support. And if you'd like to help out, you can donate via Patreon. As always, thanks for listening.